Okay, are we ready? More or less everybody here, yes. So we continue with the disclosure initiative. I give the floor to Kristy.
Yes. So the you move to agenda paper 8A, which is giving you an overview of the disclosure initiative. So before we move into some detailed amendments to IS1, which Amy will cover in agenda paper 8B, we thought it was important to give you some detailed or some context to those amendments and give you an overview of what we propose to undertake as part of the area of disclosure, so as part of what we're calling the disclosure initiative. So if, in this paper, I will go through a bit about the background of the initiative, what we perceive to be the disclosure problem, the next steps, and that's really the different projects that form the disclosure initiative, a bit about the timeline and how it links into the conceptual framework. So on page 3 of the presentation, this really provides you with some background of how we've arrived to where we are with the disclosure initiative. And in the agenda consultation, there was a message that a disclosure framework is needed to ensure that information disclosed is more relevant to investors and to reduce the burden of preparers. And it was considered that that work or disclosure framework would be undertaken as part of the conceptual framework. And as the work on the conceptual framework developed, it was viewed that many of the issues that were raised in the agenda consultation on disclosures wouldn't be covered in that work. In addition to that, we held a disclosure forum in January, which we heard a lot of messages about disclosures and the disclosure problem. And those messages combined, we pulled together a feedback statement. And this disclosure initiative really does pull together the ISB's response into the, in that feedback statement. I would also mention, as a in response to that feedback statement, we have brought those messages and what we intend or tend to do to both CMAC, GPF, and the Advisory Council. So if I move to slides 5 and 6, and this is really what is the problem we're trying to address, and I think 5 and 6 are trying to show that there are many reasons why we have it or perceived to be why we have a disclosure problem, and it results in many views as to what that problem is. I think overall there is a sense that disclosures are not as effective as they could be, and so we're trying to address what that, you know, aspects of that concern. So if I move to next steps, so this multifaceted or you know, a problem which has many characteristics, I think we have felt needed to be dealt with a project or initiative which has many different aspects itself. So on page 8, I think we set out what we see as being the disclosure initiative and the projects that sit underneath that. And so it really, again, it represents what the ISB's response was in the disclosure forum feedback statement that we issued in May. So we see the disclosure initiative as consisting of 5 projects, tentatively, and it's split between what we think are short-term and long-term projects in nature. And I'll go through each of those in a bit more detail in the next slides. So the first project deals with some amendments to IS1, and I think this is to address what we think have been some literal interpretations of language in IS1 which have not been helpful. And I won't go into too much detail about those, what we're proposing to do there. That's set out on slide 10, and it's basically what Amy's going to cover in her paper now. One thing that's not in Amy's paper, which we will deal with in October, is the issue of net debt reconciliations, and we'll bring a paper in October on that point. It's most probably a good point on slide 11 to indicate that as well as the work that we're doing on IS1 as part of the disclosure initiative, there is also some parallel work happening on IS1 that's come from the Interpretations Committee. And so we felt that given there was this movement or this work on IS1 at the same time, it made sense to look at those amendments or possible amendments as one package. So you'll see this sort of time frame, the agenda time that we have today, is being presented as a package between what we're proposing as part of the disclosure initiative and some other amendments to IS1 which are being brought through the Interpretations Committee, and you'll see those as agenda paper C and D, which April and Tim will present. The next project that's part of the exposure initiative is on slide 12, which is materiality. And I have a short-term project here, but I think it's the time frame we're looking at is doing some research into materiality and bringing a first paper to the board in Q1 next year. And that really will try and determine whether we should look to produce further guidance or education material or something on materiality and the application of materiality. That project we would hope to work, or we've started to work with both the IAASB and securities regulators to get a view of how this, you know, if such guidance is needed, and if so, what the scope and the form of that proposal would be.
Christy, just a question on that. Is this the more tightly defined issue of materiality of disclosures, assessing materiality of disclosures, or is it broader guidance on what we mean by material, that an item is material?
I think it could be both. I think it's the broader view of what is material, though I think as part of the conceptual framework, the board made a tentative decision or had a tentative view that the concept of materiality should not be changed, but that there maybe was or recognised that people were having problems applying it. So I think part of what we propose to bring in in Q1 would be an assessment of how broad a scope we want to make this materiality project. And are the problems primarily around disclosures and, say, qualitative aspects of materiality, or do we see that people are actually having some issues regarding perhaps what we'd think of the more everyday, I don't know, what people often perceive to be the materiality problem, which is, you know, misstatements in the primary financial statements.
I think my first reaction, especially thinking about this as an action point coming out of the discussion around, is there disclosure overload? Should we be, response from the forum that we had in January, is to focus more narrowly on the issue of assessing materiality of disclosures, which you started to do in one of the papers. I think it's going to be a challenging issue because it's a live wire for many people, and the more we can make it responsive to a specific issue, I think maybe the more we increase our chances of success.
And I think that there's going to be a lot of focus on this initial paper to really define what the objective and scope of that project is, because I think you're right, it could be as broad as you want it to be, and to be effective and timely it needs to be very, very clear about what it's doing and what it's covering.
I mean, certainly if we were going down the track of looking at issues around assessing materiality of disclosures and it identified a bigger issue or related to something more fundamental, I'd say then we should think about what we do, do about it. Mm-hmm. But rather than saying we want to address start with the broad in order to get to the specific disclosure issue, I think we could wander for a long time.
Chris, could I have a simple question on page 11? In the middle, have an item, presentation item of OCI arising from equity accounted investment. What does that mean?
That's part of the paper which Stephen is bringing in soon, in an hour. An hour.
Paper 8D.
8D.
So hold your breath.
This is why I want to highlight.
Any other questions? Okay. So the other short-term project I have here, and I put it short-term, but I think it's more ongoing, is review of new disclosure requirements. And I think this is formalising some of the streams or activities we already have been doing on disclosures and getting a consistency in the wording and the nature of the objectives that we write in new EDs. And also I think it would link in well with the objectives and what we're trying to do in the conceptual framework and trying to, how do we stream those objectives down into actually writing the standards. I think it may go a bit further because we've had some discussions, say, with GPF and CMAC about possible ways of drafting standards, and we've had some reaction towards that, so it may go further. I think the key thing that we need to deal with in this aspect of the project is how we formalise it, how we process it, how can we make this more operational and get into new disclosures so that they're getting the attention that they need in the standard setting process.
Yeah. And it's not a review of existing standards disclosures, it's more of a case of having a collective view of how do we draft across the board on new ones. The review would be later, which is the point Christy will talk about now.
Yeah. So now we move into the green, I quite like that, because it's the longer term projects, and there's two of these, and they're both effectively research projects. The first one is what we would see as a potential replacement of IS1, IS7 and IS8 and bringing in some of the work that we've already done on the financial statement presentation project. I think this project really picks up where the conceptual framework leaves off, and I think that's reflected in the timeline we project for this aspect of the disclosure initiative, in that we would hope to do research on the work that's already been done in this area for up until the next agenda consultation, with a view to proposing something in the agenda consultation in 2015, which should link into when the conceptual framework is being finalised. So it's sort of. I think we've said in another part of this presentation that it works. Some of the disclosure initiative works in parallel with the conceptual framework. I see this part sort of in parallel, but also almost a relay and picking up where the conceptual framework maybe ends. And I think then the... Yep.
You are not talking about disclosure issues. But all these three standards are presentation, basically, in nature.
But I think presentation is a form of disclosure, and I think it's a very fine line between... It depends on the entity whether something is presentation and whether something's disclosure. And I think you can't look at disclosure without looking at presentation, because I think it's a very fluid transfer between the two. And I do see presentation as a form of disclosure.
And then if that is the case, why not include some of the major standards on disclosure also?
As in IFRS 7, for example, or?
Yes, 12, recently finalised.
We can look at that. I would see this as a more standalone principle. You know, we could maybe look at having all the standards together. I mean, I hadn't thought of that, but that could be something to be addressed as part of the research.
I follow what you just said. You know, you feel disclosure is a broad term, mm-hmm. including presentation and disclosure. This is why I follow 50.
But the idea is that in slide 15, once you've got the, I'll call it the framework, but once you've got a sense of what an income statement looks like and a balance sheet and essentially how the notes should be constructed to relate to that, then you can actually go back and go through the other standards that we've got and see what changes we might need to make to those requirements. But otherwise, you'd end up going through... you may as well take everything and have a look at it, and I think that's just too much. The idea is to say, well, we've got the information in the balance sheet, what supporting information in the notes is appropriate, and you know, when should we have more, when should we have less, and so on. Then go and look at property, plant, and equipment, then look at IFRS 7 and so on.
My last question is, what's this project the relationship with the conceptual frameworks, whether mean the all the items covered by the DP is already there and should be blocked, and others should be in this project.
I think the conceptual framework brings in the principles and the objectives, so I see what we have in the discussion paper as broadly staying in there, you know, based depending on the responses and final views of the board, but that is, this conceptual framework has brought, you know, sets out the principles and the high-level objectives, and I see that the scope that's currently in there is being appropriate, whether others do is for discussion. But what this then does is gives that broader detail, gives it a lot more detail about disclosures and presentation, which is outside the scope of the conceptual framework, and it really is covering the types of issues, you know, that we're being asked about: detailed presentation questions, format of presentation in financial statements, we had some broad principles about that in the conceptual framework, but we don't go into a lot of detail about that.
Very high level.
And this is trying to create that framework, which, you know, we have had a lot of questions of, particularly from users, about wanting more about presentation and principles around presentation and disclosure. So I don't see this as overriding what's in the conceptual framework. I see this as being added to. It's the standards level work, which is the conceptual framework sits above.
Please continue.
Okay. So actually, on slide 15, and maybe goes to your earlier point, Wegwo, which is we also, over the next few years leading up to the next agenda consultation, would look to review existing standards and assess whether an additional project would be needed in terms of duplication or overlaps or conflicts. And again, I see this as linking in or needing to sort of base itself on what we decide in the conceptual framework. Then just I move quickly to slide 17, which gives you sort of an overview of our proposed timelines for the various aspects of the disclosure initiative. As you can see, Rights 1 amendments, we hope to have deliberations during this year and then publish an ED in Q1. Materiality, again, a first paper, hopefully by Q1 next quarter. New EDs are ongoing. And then the two research projects really picking up until the next agenda consultation. And then finally, on page 19, I have a slide which talks about the interaction with the conceptual framework. And I see that as, in some cases, working in parallel, especially in terms of materiality and how we're drafting new exposure drafts, but also perhaps, as I was saying, more as a subsequent or picking up where the conceptual framework leaves off, in particular for the research projects, the FSP, and the broader review of the standards. So that's the end of the presentation on agenda paper 8A. Does anybody have any further comments or points they want to raise on that?
For sure.
I understand why we're putting these sort of disparate things together as an amendment to IAS1, because constituents were complaining about the number of documents they were getting. On the other hand, we've had constituents complaining about annual improvements and burying major changes in annual improvements, things that were bigger. So I guess I'm okay with doing these together, but I think we're going to have to sort of put a big neon sign on the ED that there are these four very different things in there.
Yeah. Stephen?
Just on the new ED's disclosure and the existing standards and the research project. So we're going to be thinking about whether disclosure shall be required, encouraged, shall, may, how we write the lists, do we have overlapping items, how long the list should be, disclosure principles. If we're going to do that for the new EDs, we've got to do it pretty quickly. So, but the research for the existing EDs comes during next year. So it seems a bit of a disconnect.
Well, I think, as I said, some of that the way we write the objectives and the examples is already filtered down. And I know when producing the disclosure piece of the conceptual framework, a lot of the objectives that we put in that were always, you know, backing off what we'd already done in some of the more recent standards. And I see your point that working, you know, forward sort of leaves the existing standards behind, and that's your concern. But I think going back, it seems difficult to go back and amend existing standards without looking at, you know, overall what the effect may be, other than, you know, making...
I just wonder what that research is, because effectively ongoing we've been doing quite a lot of work on disclosures. It might have been slightly disconnected in the sense that the thinking has been done by different teams, but we have migrated quite a lot in terms of the way we think about disclosure. So what is that research that's going to take place next year?
Well, I think it's where we think that any existing disclosure requirements might be contrary to where we are now, so where, you know, they've been developed before practice moved on. I think it also is, are there any areas where there is duplication or conflict? Perhaps, you know, picking up some work that's already been done about reviewing disclosures that we already have. Are any redundant disclosures there that are not being made? I think that's the type of research, in addition to, you know, how we draft objectives going forward.
Yeah, I think to Stephen's point as well, I think you're asking, Steve, you know, we are doing things like being prescriptive about disclosures already, so we're making those changes. But we have had a bit of feedback from preparers and others. You know, are they enforceable? Are you going to get more variation in practice? And so we're just trying to be a bit cautious about leaping and making big changes to the way we do the wording. Because, you know, my personal view is we've got to improve the clarity of the objective to start with, and then work with some of the open questions we've got are perhaps we need to have longer lists of things and say they're indicative. And we bounce the idea of having items on lists that deliberately overlap. So you can't use it as a checklist because some of these are alternative ways of presenting things. And the feedback you get from some of the users is they'd rather have a bit more, slightly narrower, get more consistency. So that we just want to be careful we don't jump and create a disclosure problem by changing the wording too much. So that we're getting some feedback on that as well.
Martin?
Yeah, one question to slide 17, because Manzit is said that all the longer term stuff is potential 2015 agenda consolidation proposal. And my reading of the 2011 agenda consolidation was that many constituents said, okay, that especially this disclosure should be the priority for the ISB in the next years, but looking at this time frame, then we have done some research end of 2014, and then we will ask again, constituents, do you like that we are doing something on disclosure? Isn't that a little bit non-responsive, what we are doing then?
I think we are doing, one, we're doing the conceptual framework on within the time frame and in response to the 2011 agenda, and we are making some headway regarding materiality, which, if I have to say, what was the sort of very strong theme coming through the forum and the survey, it is around materiality and the application of materiality. So I do think we are being responsive. I also think that we are... showing sort of obvious traction to develop going forward, you know, a broader project on disclosures. And I think we do need a lot of time to research what is already done. And given the work we're building up in the conceptual framework, I think this sort of time frame does make sense from that perspective. So I think we are, to a certain extent, addressing what we said we would do in the agenda consultation.
Yeah, and it won't just be a do we do something on it. The idea is to get some research and discussion paper type of material out there. So we say, look, this is the shape of what we think we want to do. Are you okay with this? And that sort of feedback we get. So because I think it's there's a bit of an overlap between disclosure principles and essentially financial statement presentation project, which was a major issue for us a couple of years ago. So we want to see if we can reshape that and then sort of say, well, is this the direction you want us to take? So it's not going to be a do we do it or not. It's here's a potential proposal. And that way we can hit the ground running straight after we go through that consultation.
Any other comments, questions to Christy? No, then I'll give the floor to, thank you, Christy. Give the floor to Amy.
So this is agenda paper 8B. And this is the first paper on the proposed narrow focus amendments to IS1, which Christy talked about earlier. We think the amendments are clarifying amendments, and some to address what we think are overly literal interpretations of IS1. And so we think these small amendments could help with some of the issues we've heard about disclosure. We've got five questions for the ISB. We've also included proposed draft wording, so any comments on this, please do provide to us directly. The first two amendments are on materiality. We heard that too much relevant information is being disclosed in financial statements, and we heard that a key cause for this is that materiality isn't being applied as well as it could be in practice for a number of reasons. So we've proposed some amendments to IS1 that clarify materiality. So the first proposed amendment is to address the misconception that disclosures specifically required by an IFRS are not subject to the materiality guidance in IS1. And we think there are two aspects to this misconception. Firstly, that materiality is only assessed within the context of the primary financial statements. And secondly, that disclosures in the notes to the financial statements specifically required by an IFRS are not subject to the materiality requirements. So we think they're both part of that misconception. So we recommend that additional...
So can I ask something? So the impression is that the notes to the financial statements is a lower threshold or higher threshold? Because the way you said it and the way I read the paper makes me think that the footnote disclosure has a lower threshold. That means you've got to disclose everything. That's very different to my understanding from practice. But so that's why I'm very curious with your comment and with the way the paper is written up.
So one of the things we heard was that if a standard specifically requires something, then they would disclose everything without applying materiality there.
And Amy and PK, I took the purpose of the paragraphs leading up to the proposed wording in paragraph 27 to be saying disconnect the assessment of the materiality of the line item in the primary financial statements from the assessment of the materiality of the disclosure requirements, that you could have a material amount and therefore line item in the primary financial statements without automatically concluding that every disclosure that relates to that amount is material. And so it's just trying to separate those and say there are two assessments to be made, not the single one. And you know, maybe your question raises a question about whether the wording that's proposed after paragraph 27 gets to that point, but I think that's what you guys were after.
I'm really surprised with that, but I don't know whether this helps to clarify that.
There's an ongoing theme in this. You'll look at a lot of these and go, I can't understand how people read it that way. But this is the feedback we've got from some quarters, that people simply find this as being a barrier. Others don't. And so we're trying to remove those barriers collectively. None of these things individually are actually that significant, in my view, but it's the collective thing and almost the sentiment that goes with this that I think will be quite powerful. But, you know, I think the team had trouble in the drafting. You know, you rationalise and say, this is what we have to change. Well, how do people read it that way? But certainly the feedback is very consistent with us.
Yeah, I have the same feeling. Read the paragraphs. How could there be a misunderstanding? But there certainly cannot be a misunderstanding after the amendments being proposed.
We also thought there was no basis. Most of these paragraphs that we're dealing with
relate to the original IS-1 or the IS-1 that was carried over in 2005. So there's no basis or no guidance surrounding that paragraph as to what the intention behind it. So part of these proposals that we're hoping we'll do will provide some of that basis or provide some of that discussion by the board as to what those paragraphs do mean.
Go on, Amy.
Okay. So we recommend that additional guidance should be added to the materiality section of IS-1 to clarify that the concept of materiality should be applied to the specific disclosure requirements set forth in a standard or interpretation. This materiality assessment should be made in addition to determining whether any related amounts should be recognised or presented in the primary financial statements. Making it clear in IS-1 that materiality applies to the specific disclosure requirements within a standard could help to alleviate some of these problems. I do note the suggestion in paragraph 28-30 about this collective assessment of materiality. That was made by a regulator, and they were concerned that the staff proposed amendment could be difficult to enforce. We think that kind of collective assessment should be taken to the other project on materiality because we think it goes further than what we're intending for this project. So the question one for the ISB is on page 9, and that is, does the ISB agree with the proposed amendment to paragraph 31 of IS-1 and the insertion of a new paragraph 31A to IS-1 for the reasons stated in paragraphs 12 to 27.
Patrick?
As a general premise, when I read the sentence, sounds fine, but then when I read it a second time, the last part of the sentence gave me pause. It says that would be 31A, the proposed insertion. Information that would be provided by that specific disclosure is not material. But what if that specific disclosure, okay, if it were omitted, would leave the entire presentation or message of the disclosure incomplete? So you know, in and of itself, as a data point, you look at it, you might say that that's immaterial, but it's necessary to make the entire mosaic, if you will, complete to understand it. So it's kind of like a piece of a puzzle down here, right, of a jigsaw puzzle. It's pulled out. You say, oh, that's immaterial too. But it leaves the entire story incomplete. And so that's the only question I have, is that you could say any one piece of a disclosure is not material, but you have to look at it collectively. And that's my only reservation to the way this is worded. And frankly, the intent. So it comes down to, I think, a lot of common sense, you know. And if a specific disclosure is going to leave the overall message, explanation of an element in the financial statement incomplete, then I think it should be provided. Because sometimes its omission is as important as its presence.
This comes back to kind of what Mary was talking about, that disconnect. And
yeah.
What we're trying to address is that if it's material, I think the example we use in the paper is about IFRS 2, so you've got a material share-based payment, are you then required to disclose everything? If it's specifically required in the standard, should you not then apply materiality to that? That's what we're trying to address. Maybe we can work on the wording.
I also think, Pat, there's an argument that it's getting to what do you think is material. And material is defined elsewhere as you know, a collective and an individual assessment. So I would say that if taking out that disclosure, even though alone was, you know, you felt for some reason that if I looked at that disclosure in isolation, whether by amount or something else, that it wasn't material, but taking it out meant that it left a big hole in the rest of the disclosure, I would argue that that is material. And so I think it goes to a very big discussion about what is material and one of the reasons why we think...
So I'm on the same page with you, I agree. How do we ensure that the people reading these words make the connection you just made?
I'm sort of on the same points, Patrick. I'm fully on board with where you are here. But as you finish off 31A, when it said, would be provided by that specific disclosure is not material. Would it be helpful to clarify is not material to an understanding of that subject? Because I don't think you mean in the context of the financial statements as a whole, the way this is set up. I think you mean to revenue recognition or derivatives, it's the context of the subject. Because, which leads me to my second point on paragraph 29, when it assess the materiality on an individual basis and on a collective basis. When I think you mean on a collective basis, if you took out 100 individual little disclosures, individually you can live without, but you mean collectively can you live without that much critical mass removed? That's what you mean, correct?
I think and one of the reasons we didn't feel comfortable bringing in a discussion of a collective assessment of materiality into this discussion is that it could mean a number of things depending on what context you're talking about. So it could mean 100 little things. It could mean collectively over periods of time. It could mean, I think, compared with other disclosures, et cetera. So I think it's quite a difficult issue.
And I agree you're not ready to have that discussion. I just wanted to make sure that I was sort of seeing it the same way you were. It's, you know, a lot of little things that cumulatively might be something big, whether they're on one subject or scattered about many. But I do think on 31A you need to clarify the context is on that subject as opposed to statements as a whole. I think the statements as a whole, very few disclosures are individually material.
Suggesting as we talk, because we've got the same theme coming through twice, whether that should be expressed in terms of having it determined that the item and the standard is material, you then need to assess whether the individual items are material within that standard. The moment we talk about don't disclose if it's immaterial, as opposed to saying, like, hey, just because it says material, you don't have to disclose everything, you then put the materiality threshold over that as well, which is a more positive way of expressing it rather than saying, well, don't.
Yeah, because here you've said the subject, the caption, or whatever, the subject is material, but doesn't automatically about every individual of 50 disclosure items necessarily are. And I think
Mary brought a very good suggestion to my attention. In paragraphs 29 and 30, you describe, I think, the concept that Gary was talking about, but you also say you chose not to incorporate that. This is what, essentially, I think is what you need.
DK?
One question, maybe this is not a big deal. The way 31 is addressed, phrased, is that what we are trying to get to is, which is there in para 27, somewhere in the middle, that this materiality assessment should be made in addition to determining whether it's an additional step that you need to do. Why not just say that in the 31A in a much more clearer way? The reason is that it's a two-step process in that sense, in my wording. You assess the materiality and the footnote disclosures kind of on a standalone basis. So I think that is not coming across here. Because, and also, maybe this is too pedantic, this is only one way. You're looking at the financial statements and discussing whether you need a disclosure in the footnotes. Can it be the other way too? But if you just say it's a separate assessment, you need to do it, that captures all situations. You don't need to think about only one way. This looks like it's only one way.
What do you mean by the other way? Is
it express it positively.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah.
As in 27, it says this material assessment should be made in addition to determining whether related amounts recognised within the primary financial statements. So Pigot's saying you've made the assessment as material, but then don't just automatically put everything. Have a second assessment of materiality. So that's that positive expression rather than saying don't disclose the immaterial.
Yeah, it's like
just apply materiality again at a second level.
That helps you to do two things, though. You look at the financial statements, disclose the things, and discuss whether you need to disclose in the footnotes. And there could be some situations, I'm just thinking in a very rudimentary way, there could be a disclosure that is required in the footnotes, may not be required separately in the financial statement. So that, the positive statement, that it's a two-statement analysis, takes care of that.
Martin?
The way I read it, I just got...
Back to what you brought up, Gerd. I'm not sure, man, is that really meant? I'll give you a short example. If, for example, you have a corporation which have only some financial instruments, which use a total financial statements are not material, but you have to do under IFRS 7 a lot of disclosure.
That's what I'm saying.
Does that mean now here, okay, is it under 31A material to that position? So the disclosure is material to the overall financial instruments or to the whole financial statements. Because I think we only get a relief from this disclosure overload if we say it should be both. It must be really, if it is immaterial, really also to the whole financial statements, we don't to provide any disclosure of that. And I think we have done that for IFRS Foundation. We had also the disclosure of the financial instruments. We have not done this table 3-4 pages because the overall financial instruments, the difference between carrying amount and fair value was not material, so we decided not to give that overall disclosure.
Can I make one observation?
And that is my question, really, because for me this wording in 31 and 31A is not clear, and it has to be, I think, amended if we mean that, okay, that the overall position is not material, then maybe you don't have to do any disclosure at all.
I think Martin makes a great observation, very critical, and this is a challenge that I know a lot of analysts have had following really big companies. You can have items that are fairly material, let's say, to a segment or a division, but in the context of, you know, Acme conglomerate, where materiality is so big, you're not going to get the disclosure if you interpret it one way, i.e., in the context of the financial statements taken as a whole. But you can never make sense, frankly, of what's going on because this is a company that's a collection of, you know, 30 different businesses. And so any one acquisition they make, whether it's multi-billion dollar, you know, is immaterial. Any one financial instrument they might hold is immaterial. But it's important to understand how the earnings are flowing and how the cash flows are flowing. So I think it's a delicate issue.
Is that concern driven by the proposals here, or I actually read that same concern or that same decision sitting in 31 at the moment, and again I think it goes to what is material, which is quite a different discussion.
For me, it is very straightforward, very easy. And for me, also when I was chief accountant, it was always a question, is okay, if you, for example, you have the disclosure to a certain balance sheet position which you have, but this balance sheet position is really not material for the company. But then you have maybe 100 disclosure requirements, and then you're struggling, do you have to fulfill this 100? And then you have to do the relation. Is that material to the individual financial statement position or to the financial statements overall?
And
that really is, I thought we want to clarify that, but from that wording here, for me it is not clear. That is really my point.
And I understand the point, and I think it's a very important point. I suppose my concern is that it's beyond what we're trying to do in this aspect.
Okay.
But I do think it is something that needs to be addressed in the broader discussion that we're doing on materiality and the materiality project.
I think that is the key point, because that is, based on my understanding, the key point of...
I agree.
Yeah.
If you said it's not material financial statements as a whole, you could end up having no disclosures, which is not what this is about either. That's right. To the subject matter itself, you know, because you've already decided the subject matter, first line through it, is material. You know, assuming you've crossed that threshold, there's a presumption, at least some disclosures on it are material. So.
I guess, Christy, what I'm hearing from you is we want to clarify the separateness of the assessment of the materiality of the line item and the materiality of the disclosure, and we want to set aside for the second stage any guidance about how you assess materiality, whether it's individual or collective, material to the related line item or financial statements as well. So that all gets packaged up and put later?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then in relation to what we have, what's proposed above question one, I agree with what PK said. I think 31A could be a much more direct statement of what we're trying to achieve in terms of separating the assessment, and maybe if we want to give examples, litigation might be an example of where we do not have a material accrual in, you know, as a line item, but where the disclosure itself is quite important, and, you know, as a disclosure. And so that's, maybe an example of the converse would help also make the point about you could have a line item that you conclude should be presented separately, but that does not mean that automatically every disclosure requirement, every disclosure identified in the standard is a material disclosure. But I think it would be helpful for all the things we just discussed about assessing materiality to be explicit in the document saying that we are planning to do this but separately, because otherwise people may wonder, is this all we're going to get?
Yeah.
I was thinking when we're going to do that and rephrase it in the way that PK has suggested, isn't a line, a sentence that is also causing this problem in paragraph 30, where you, at the end, where you say an item that is not sufficiently material to warrant separate presentation may warrant separate presentation in the notes. That is, could we make it clear that this is, not okay, this will not, that it will require separate observation or analysis whether this is the case or not.
You agree that it's a may, not yeah. will.
Jambu?
Okay.
Yes. Yes, I agree with you. The many points raised here, we need some kind of clarification. And one more thing, this is a minor, but the term of disclosures, make some kind of uniform terminology, Sometimes disclosure is implying both the financial statements and note disclosure. Another time, we are saying disclosure just only for note disclosure. Even these paragraphs in ISO 1, some paragraphs maybe, some. So I'm saying if we can, then we organize disclosure terms to specific uses. That might help many of our readers outside in the world, I guess.
Okay, so I guess we generally support this suggestion, but we received some wording suggestions. Go on, Amy, to the next issue.
So the next recommendation is still under the clarifying amendments about materiality and the idea of too much irrelevant information being disclosed. So we recommend that wording should be included in the materiality paragraphs of IAS 1 to increase awareness of how disclosing immaterial information could obscure useful financial information. Mm-hmm. And the question is set out on page 12. Does the ISB agree with the proposed amendments to, inclusion of paragraph 30A of IAS 1 for the reasons stated in paragraphs 31 to 35 above?
Can I? It's what we call in Dutch kicking in an open door, but sometimes that is necessary. Zach?
I agree with the staff recommendation, and it's an improvement. But the fundamental problem of this materiality is the preparer or auditors cannot know what the user's needs is. And actually, IS 1, paragraph 7 provides there are many uses, and you have to assess. And in 38, in your proposal, you say that there are many cases you have to assess. So my question is, we have a materiality notion in IS1, and we are providing standards individually, and always we have a discussion how much materiality should be applied to this standard. Then we always coming back to IS1, we have materiality notion, and we do not have to define the materiality threshold on each individual standard. However, as it is described in your proposal, there are many cases materiality could be different, could vary from standard to standard. So my suggestion is in IS1, we should imply that each material threshold or material guidance could be addressed in each individual standard, so that we can set some kind of a notion of the materiality in each standard. The reason why I'm saying is, say for example, we are now discussing a lease project, and the purpose of the lease project is clear. However, it may capture lots of immaterial contracts. And then if the purpose of our project is to provide good information for the users to make their economic decision, it is clear in the IS-1. However, the situation might be different. In the case of lease, it must be clarified more precisely. So if we could improve our IS-1 to allow each standard to give kind of a threshold, would alleviate lots of friction with the constituents. Yeah.
Okay. Jack, maybe I'm not there. I'm sorry, this is too early in the morning for me. I'm struggling. Tell me, what do you mean by materiality standard by standard?
I mean, yes, thank you very much. Not exactly standard by standard, but whenever we discuss new standards, we provide good principle and we provide good proposal. However, sometimes it causes a lot of friction for the small transactions, and it depends on the nature of the transaction. So in the case of lease transaction, they have lots of small lease transactions. But in the case of capital fundraising or something, then normally transaction itself is one-off and big. So the materiality concept is quite different from lease cases and capital fundraising cases. So therefore, my concern is just simply rely on IS-1 doesn't really provide good guidance of materiality when we each preparers or auditors apply.
Doug, is that not exactly what we do when we consider practical expedience? So for example, the one-year exemption in the Lisa standard is taking a view on materiality in that sense.
Yeah, can I respond? I think it's good to have a practical expedient in each standard. However, if we depend on providing practical expedient one by one, it would end up in the rule base. Say, for this case, just 1 year. For this case, then 6 months. For this case, 10%, whatever. We would like to avoid that. So maybe if we could improve some materiality threshold for each standard, so that to make clear in each standard, the purpose of this standard is to clarify this purpose. I mean, say for example,
what would it be different though?
That would not be rule based.
Yeah,
I don't think so. But what I'm saying,
what would you say in that?
Yeah, I understand what you want to say, but you know what we can do. For example, in your I can assume in your mind, for example, a big firm, you know, rent 1,000 mobile phone for its staff. Let's assume that the term is more than 1 year. Mm-hmm. And you will feel it not necessary to account for based on our, you know, the capitalized lease models. Am I right?
Yeah.
Then how can we write?
Yeah. So then
down the materiality requirements in the lease standards. How can we write?
Yeah. My idea is we should make clear the purpose, and then make clear the what the user really wants. And what kind of judgment is necessary to judge IS-1's materiality. I mean, IS-1 clearly said does it change the decision of investor? So then, fine, it's fine, it's clear. However, in the case of lease, what is the point that user could change their decision? And then when we make new standard, we have an idea. So then we should write it in the each standard. We can write it in each standard. But the discussion is always, there is a materiality concept in IS1, so we don't have to write materiality statement in each individual standard. So then we normally do not talk about such kind of things in each standard. But
this is probably more revolutionary than what we try to do here.
So if it could be I
think this discussion will have to be resumed when we discuss materiality and more fundamentally. But we got a pre-taste of what Tuck is preparing.
Stay on the board.
Okay.
Is that agree with question two?
Could we agree with staff's suggestion? Yes? Okay. Not quite with Tuck's suggestions yet, but that can come.
So the next amendment starts on page 13. We've heard that entities feel that IS1 prevents them from disaggregating the line items listed for inclusion in the Statement of Financial Position, and this is from paragraph 54 of IS1. So we recommend that paragraph 54 should be amended to clarify that the line items listed in that paragraph can be disaggregated and should be disaggregated if it provides relevant information. And we also recommend that paragraph 82 of IS1, which includes the list of line items for P&L, should be amended to be consistent with paragraph 54. So the question for the board is, on page 17, does the ISB agree with the proposed amendment to paragraph 54 of IS1 for the reasons stated in paragraphs 36 to 45? And do you also agree that a similar amendment should be made to paragraph 82 of IS1?
Agreed?
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Okay, so the next amendment, page 18. And this is to address the perception that IS1 requires an entity to present their notes of the financial statements in a particular order. We don't think that paragraph 114 of IS1 was intended to be a strict order of the notes to the financial statements, but instead give an example of how the notes could be ordered. So we recommend that the wording of paragraph 114, including subparagraph 114C, should be amended to clarify that the order shown in that paragraph is not a requirement but only an example. We also recommend that wording should be included in paragraph 113 of IS1 to emphasise that an entity should consider the impact on both understandability and comparability when determining the order of the notes to financial statements. And the question is on page 21. Does the ISB agree with the proposed amendments to paragraph 113 and 114 of IS1 for the reasons stated in paragraphs 49 to 62?
I personally do not really agree with staff's recommendation. What you are saying is true. Of course, it's a discretion of the preparers. However, if each preparer make notes in different order, perhaps for the users and readers, it's quite difficult to find out whether there is a note or not. And actually, the volume of disclosure is already huge. The pages, numbers of the pages are quite large. And then, if you want to know what is going on for that entity, you have only the specific information to catch rather than to read through the from the top to the end. So then, if there is a kind of proper order, it's quite difficult to catch where is that information located. So therefore, we need some kind of a discipline, but I don't think we should require it. So in this sense, the word normally gives a kind of discipline to keep some order. So therefore, I rather prefer the wording normally rather than could be. This is my opinion.
Any other comments? Martin?
Only one. Man, I'm really not convinced if that is really helping, because man, I don't know anybody who is reading the notes from the beginning to the end. And so it's more like the people looking, okay, I'm interested in, I don't know, financial instrument disclosure, looking at a specific footnote. And therefore, I think if there is some comparability, that I find footnotes maybe usually in section 7 or 8 of the footnotes, I think is very, very helpful. And I don't know if we really need that, because understandability, I don't know if the order of this footnote really helps to engage, to help better understandability. So I'm really not so convinced if we should not focus more on really have an order which people can compare, really, and usual companies, okay, they have the maybe the policy footnote under section 2 and then starts with P&L footnotes and balance sheet footnotes, and they have a kind of orientation where they find stuff in order to say the order really helps to understand footnote disclosure. I'm not so convinced if that is really helping.
I think one of the examples that's often this wording prevents is companies who would like to disaggregate their accounting policy disclosure and put, say, the accounting policy in with the relevant note, and have said that this wording has prevented them from making that split because it would require...
Yeah, but I think then we should make that, but this wording allows maybe also companies then to maybe have the policy disclosure footnote in maybe footnote number 65, and then people trying to find that and compare it with usually other companies have it in the beginning, and I don't know if that will add more confusion than it really helps. If that only what we want to achieve is really that some people want to have the...
Add a sentence that it is allowed to disaggregate.
This aggregation is good. For example, if somebody say, okay, I want to have my policy footnote, how I account for financial instruments when I speak about financial instruments, that I think should be allowed. But it should not lead to that. I think the good thing is currently that it is a kind of order that people...
It's largely dictated by the order of the P&L.
Yeah, but I think it helps, because man, as I said, nobody is reading the footnotes as a book.
Yeah.
And it is really people like, I want to know, okay, what is really the detailed disclosure for this company for leases, for example. And then they look, okay, usually it is okay, all balance sheet items are structured in a way and coming, and then it's kind of orientation to help find some stuff.
But I think there's also been examples where, say, companies have entered into a big acquisition and business combinations have historically been, what, note 40-something because of IFRS when it came in, but because it was such a big event during the year, they'd brought it up to number 4. So I think that gives you another indication of an example where, because of certain circumstances, you may change that order. And we're not saying that this requires you to be active in changing
but Christy, but also, man, if I have want to look, for example, what another company want to have accounting policy, how to account for leases, I think it is helpful if everybody has that in the policy footnote and not in the leases footnote, because then I can find it and I can read it, and I don't have to look at, okay, is that company doing it in the leasing footnote, others doing that for in the policy footnote, and I'm lost to find really the information which I'm looking for. Sorry?
I've heard different views from people on that point. So you
okay,
you,
but
you
I have a different view, and that is what I think is preferable to give more freedom, because I'm not convinced that the order of that would lead to disclosure overload. I'm not convinced about that.
But I also think the amendment, which is trying to clarify what's there, I don't think we're trying to say you've got to, you know, amend the order. And I think we acknowledge both of those views, that some people wanted this consistency with other entities and some people would prefer a different order.
Well, why don't we just leave in normally? Because that is the run-of-the-mill, probably. But then make clear that there can be circumstances in which you do it differently. And then I think we get... I do agree with everybody's... I don't think, you know, I think the order of the notes will probably follow very... follow almost logically from the P&L and the balance sheet in the order of that. So I don't think there's a danger that will go all over the place.
Yeah, although normally is the word that was probably given to us, and you could say commonly, you know, a common method.
Will that help for these people?
Normally they're saying that you wouldn't say that this is normal. You've got to prove to me it's abnormal.
Yeah, you have to be abnormal to not do that. but then you have to be uncommon to do it.
They're the leaders. Is that right? The uncommon leaders.
Well, I think you catch the drift of the discussion, and perhaps the current wording is going a little bit overboard. Yes. So try to find a happy medium. We'll see it when it comes back. Stephen?
I wanted to comment upon 113 and just to ask the auditors in the room whether you think auditors are going to ask for evidence that it enhances understandability and comparability. Whether we're creating a problem for ourselves with that word.
There are no auditors in the room. There may be some former auditors in the room being asked the question. PK?
This is motherhood and apple pie. I for me, this is inconsequential, but if it satisfies somebody, go ahead and do it, not yourself. For me, it doesn't sway me one way or the other, honestly.
So I think, Steve, you're asking, it's an incremental thing, whether we use a language such as whether it not improves understandability, but...
that's the basic purpose, though.
Saying, systematic manner, that enhances the understandability. So
but that's the
do
basic
I have to demonstrate it enhances understandability? I'm just thinking of what comments we might get down the road.
Yeah. Can I respond to that? I'm not wedded to those words, but the concept there is what made me comfortable with removing the normally in the next sentence, because I think what Martin was alluding to and some of what Tak was saying suggested that, well, if you remove this orderly requirement, then people are going to hide the footnotes that they don't want you to see, and it's going to be very hard to figure out where the information is. And so what made it comfortable, you know, it said, well, this is going to enhance the user, the readability for the users and understandability. And so as long as the order doesn't distract, maybe you want to turn it around. I don't know. I don't think we should be wordsmithing here, but I think the notion is that you don't have to have it in a rigorous order, but whatever order it's in should be improving the understandability of the financial statements as a whole.
That's a basic, what I'm trying to say is that's a basic underpinning of the footnotes itself. What is the purpose of footnotes to start with? To increase the understandability, enhance the understandability of the basic financial statement, because when you read the notes along with the basic financial statement, read together, they will improve the understandability. So that's why I said it's motherhood and apple pie.
Yes, but what we're correcting was motherhood and apple pie. But we're making the corrections anyway. So I was just wondering whether we introduce another one and they have difficulty with that.
It's superfluous to some extent, honestly.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah. Maybe I'm being too cavalier here, but it's definitely superfluous.
The number of comments, one is, Christy, I'm more where you are than perhaps where Martin is. I think just having the option to reorganize the collective communication in an order that at least you believe then preferably increases the understandability or comparability or both is a good thing. It doesn't mean they will. I think it just gives it clarifies that you've got the opportunity to do so if you want. And as someone who spent a lot of time responding to investor questions that come in through our investors or office that's made a way to me, is many times you're given the answer in through four different sections of the footnotes, compounded by there's information, say the management's discussion outside of that you got to put into it too. So I think everything in one place, I think, is a good option to have if someone chooses to do it. And I think just as I look back through the history of the accounting policy note, it, 50 years ago, at least in the States, when they said there should be note one, it's because there was many, many options and everything. as this board and the other boards have worked together, there's fewer and fewer accounting options left in any given subject. Now, there's none. There certainly is some. And your policy about when is something an amortized cost, say, versus fair value is not important, to be sure. But I think the accounting policy, opening the first note, is less important, perhaps today, than it was 35 years ago.
Yeah, on the same note, I support paragraph 114. I think that it gives flexibility to highlight what is really important to know for this current year, like a change in accounting policy this year, new accounting standards, revenues change as a result of the new project on revenues, and to put the permanent and the ones that do not change maybe somewhere else that people don't need to read this year to understand what's going on. So I have some sympathy for that. On paragraph 113, I would like to ask why the objective would be to enhance either understandability or comparability, or both. Why did you say or? Seems to me that those two objectives are not
mutually exclusive.
Mutually exclusive, and they do enhance each other. I think understandability does encompass.
Do you want to say and or is it? Do you want to say and or is it or. Say and? No, do you want to say and or just say and?
Okay. I would say and because to me comparability does enhance understandability.
And
I don't see why we should seem to be making a divergence here. So I think
I think there is a trade-off between understandability and comparability, because comparability usually means not with yourself over years, which I think is what you're thinking. But I think most people think of comparability as with their peers, and so if everybody wants comparability, then you've got to have this very rigid order so that everybody looks the same. But understandability, it may be, as you said, more important to have this footnote first this year because that's the most important thing that affected your business this year. But everybody else has it as the last note because it didn't affect them this year. So I think there's a trade-off between comparability and understandability.
The fact that you put the notes in a different order does not necessarily reduce comparability. You can still compare two entities, except that one disclosure is note one and the other one has put it in note four, but still you have the same information.
Yeah.
I don't think it is against comparability to have a different order.
Let's make it and or, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So another problem solved. Mary.
Oh. I have a concern about just how an entity could apply this from year to year. I mean, one of the challenges that people have raised in our post-implementation review and segment reporting is that from time to time, and sometimes more frequently than not, what is classified in one segment moves to another segment. Segments are consolidated, they're expanded, etc. So information is lost. Question I have is, if now you have a kind of a open pen to organize your notes any way you want, do you put, you know, the notes in one order one year and notes in another order the following year, simply because you believe, in your view, that's going to enhance comparability? And I think if somebody is going to interpret that way, I think that would be a step backwards. So while I understand that the note order shouldn't necessarily be rigid, mm-hmm. I'm also worried about someone becoming too freewheeling with their ordering of the notes from year to year.
You're talking about consistency from year to year.
Yeah.
But doesn't that detract sometimes from enhancing understandability, because
it could. But someone might argue the opposite. So it's a judgment call. So when you give people this discretion, you could be contributing or you could be, you know, detracting from.
We feel that normally gives people the discretion now. I mean, and that there's wording that in 113 that says it has to be a systematic order and there has to be some reason behind that order. And I think that's effectively we're trying to put some colour around that right. discretion that we think normally provides, and also what that systematic order or the considerations you have to have for that.
And what, one of the points I think that's coming through here from all the comments, Philippe's and Martin's and Tox's, is this is a trade-off. There are some benefits we'll get with this, but you're going to lose some benefits too. And
you know, if we say could, for example, then it becomes one of many possibilities to really do what you want. I think that's not what we intend to say. So with the rewording, I think.
No.
Yeah, but if we just
we should solve this problem.
But I think we're getting all caught up in trying to do a group editorial and drafting by committee, and it is important what we say, but I think we thought it was okay before, so maybe what matters more in this case is what we say in the basis for why we're making a change, rather than getting very excited about trying to get precise words here, because I think what we would be explaining is context for why there's a change being proposed is we never intended to imply that we prescribe that we require a specific format for the financial statements or a specific order. We got feedback that some people thought the word normally created a very high threshold for varying it at all, which wasn't our intention. You know, we know that we could think about whether we put in something about, you know, comparability and generally consistency. We expect that consistency would be useful. Here's your parameters. You know, this
I
is,
hope so.
You know, just say that more in the basis rather than cluttering it to explain why we're making a change when we didn't think there was really a problem here, but we're trying to respond to the feedback we got. And it just hopefully would make a lot more sense.
A very quick comment. I think it's a bit strange to try to impose comparability in the notes, whereas at the same time, there is no comparability in the presentation itself. We give very, very little guidance in the format of financial statements. And two financial statements between companies are not comparable directly, except for maybe one line, revenue, and maybe OCI. But in between, it's freedom. Large. And so why would we want more comparability in the notes than in the statements themselves?
So why did you want the or change to and, so that in order it had to do both understandability and comparability?
I'm not first on comparability.
Now you're arguing against comparability.
I'm not really first on comparability for the notes.
Really. So does this, is this stuff?
We can work.
Now you understand why these poor people applying our standards get confused.
But we need to work on the drafting.
Yes.
So the last amendment is about significant accounting policies, and we've heard that IS1 contains language in the significant accounting policy requirements which make it difficult to argue that an accounting policy is insignificant. So we think that including the income taxes example as an accounting policy that users would expect to be disclosed contradicts some of the guidance given as to what a significant accounting policy is. So we recommend that paragraph 120 of IS1 be amended to remove the income taxes accounting policy example. So question 5 is, does the ISB agree with the proposed amendments to paragraph 120 of IS1 for the reasons stated in paragraph 63 to 69?
Yes. Yes. Okay, thank you, Amy. I propose we take a break till 10:30 and then we do the rest of the morning session.
Okay. Michael should be advised that he will come up straight after 8:00.